Welcome to Disc 4 of the Marriage Max production of Marriage Fitness. Now, here again is the author, Mort Fertel.
Give Presence Marriage Assessment 1. This assessment measures how well you know your spouse and your ability to give them what they want. Answer the following questions and then ask your spouse how many questions you answered correctly. Calculate your score and compare it with the assessment scale given afterwards. 1. What's your spouse's favorite color? 2. What's your spouse's favorite city to visit? 3. What's your spouse's favorite vacation destination? 4. What's your spouse's favorite restaurant? 5. What's your spouse's favorite type of food? 6. What's your spouse's favorite home-cooked meal? 7. What's your spouse's favorite dessert? 8. What's your spouse's favorite holiday? 9. What's your spouse's most dreaded holiday? 10. Who's your spouse's best friend? 11. Who's your spouse's favorite relative? 12. What's your spouse's favorite clothing store? 13. What size shirt or blouse does your spouse wear? 14. What size pants or skirt does your spouse wear? 15. What size suit or dress does your spouse wear? 16. What size shoe does your spouse wear? 17. What's your spouse's favorite thing for you to wear? 18. What's your spouse's favorite day of the week? 19. What's the most relaxing thing for your spouse? 20. What's most stressful for your spouse? 21. What's your spouse's most dreaded chore? 22. What's your spouse's pet peeve? 23. What's the one thing your spouse has always wanted? 24. Who's your spouse's favorite actor? 25. What's your spouse's favorite movie? 26. Who's your spouse's favorite artist? 27. Who's your spouse's favorite musician? 28. What type of music does your spouse like the best? 29. What is your spouse's favorite way of making love? 30. How often per month or week does your spouse like to make love? 31. Who is your spouse's favorite author? 32. What's your spouse's all-time favorite book? 33. What type of books does your spouse like to read? 34. What's your spouse's favorite spectator sport? 35. Who is your spouse's favorite sports hero? 36. What's your spouse's favorite sports team? 37. What is your spouse's favorite hobby? 38. At what temperature does your spouse like the thermostat set? 39. What is your spouse's favorite topic of discussion? 40. If your spouse had an extra $100 a week to spend, what would your spouse choose to spend it on? 41. If your spouse was given $1 million and had to spend it within 1 week, what would be the first high-ticket item your spouse would buy? 42. Which type of vacation does your spouse prefer? A. Sun, fun, and relax. B. Sightseeing. Or C. Outdoor adventure. 43. The best type of gift for my spouse is something A. practical, B. sentimental, C. just what they ask for, or D. a surprise. 44. My spouse prefers to wear or buy A. gold, B. silver, or C. platinum. Now ask your spouse how many of these questions you answered correctly and calculate your score. 0 to 19. Out of shape. You have a lot to learn about your spouse. Ask more questions. Pay closer attention during conversation. Concentrate during your intimacy interview, which will be discussed in a few moments. 20 to 31. Average. You know enough to give some of the right things, but you could do better. Review the questions you got wrong and try to identify areas about your spouse where your knowledge is lacking. Make an effort to learn about them. Focus on them during your intimacy interview. 32 to 44. Marriage Fitness Champion. Your knowledge of your spouse will make giving much easier. Keep building your knowledge bank. Giving based on fresh understandings is very powerful, so don't rest on your laurels. Intimacy Interview. Exercise 2.1. Program. One per spouse per year. Did you ever hear the question, does a tree that falls make noise if no one is around to hear it? So many things in life require pairs in order for them to be actualized. For example, a teacher needs a student. A person may have the potential to teach, but a person only becomes a teacher when he teaches a student. In the same way, a giver needs a receiver. You may want to give your spouse something, but if your spouse doesn't want to receive it, you can't give it. Imagine my wife and I want to surprise you with a 5-course, home-cooked gourmet meal. So I call you on the phone and I ask you to come to my house at 7 o'clock in the evening because we have something important to talk to you about. You don't know what the agenda is, nor do you know how long the discussion will last. Since you didn't have dinner, you stop at a fast food restaurant and eat a couple of burgers and french fries in the car while you drive to our house. Upon your arrival, my wife and I escort you to our dining room and surprise you with a beautifully set table and a 5-course, home-cooked gourmet meal. We're so excited to give you dinner, but we can't. We went to great lengths to give you something special, but we forgot to do the most important thing. We forgot to make sure you would want it. In order for you and your spouse to give to each other, you need to know each other's needs. Don't wait 20 years for one of you to tell the therapist that the other never says, "I love you." Tell each other what you want. How do you and your spouse get a list of things that the other wants? How do you know what to give? You have to ask. I suggest intimacy interviews. An intimacy interview is when one spouse interviews the other about their wants. After you interview each other, you and your spouse will have a comprehensive list of each other's wants, a list of things to give to each other. Here are some logistical suggestions for a successful interview. If the interview is done properly, it could take a couple of hours. Therefore, I suggest only one interview per evening. Try to schedule the other interview within 10 days of the first. Whoever conducts the interview should have a laptop computer or a pen and a pad so that there will be a list you can refer to and edit over the years. Make sure the kids are asleep and the TV is off. agree with your spouse that neither of you will answer the phone during the interview, nor accept any interruptions other than emergencies. Put some refreshments on the table, light a candle, and dim the lights. Begin each interview by discussing its purpose. You can listen to passages from this chapter to remind each other of the main points. The interviewer should encourage the interviewee to be as open and detailed as possible. Remind each other that this is your chance to ask for everything you ever wanted. The interviewer should only ask questions and seek to clarify their spouse's desires. The interviewer should not make statements, comments, or remarks of any kind. In terms of facial expressions and body language, the interviewer should react only in a neutral or positive way, and be careful not to discourage the interviewee from exposing themselves. The interviewee, on the other hand, should not ask questions. The interviewee should remain focused on exploring their desires. Sex is often a difficult topic to discuss openly. Help each other with this topic. Extend a special effort to be sensitive to each other and work hard to create a safe environment. The interviewer can help by asking specific questions. It's much easier to respond to an inquiry than it is to volunteer information. When you get to the topic of sex, you might try turning off the lights and lighting a candle. It feels much safer to share in the dark. The interviewer can begin the interview by simply asking what the other wants. The interviewee should download everything they want in life. The questions and answers should be as detailed as possible. For example, if one of you says you want a back rub after lovemaking, you should discuss how hard or soft, with or without moisturizer, and what part of the back is the most favorite. If one of you wants the house to be a certain temperature, discuss exactly how to set the thermostat. Love is in the details. Ask about details. Get intimate. You and your spouse should know each other better than anyone else in the world. You should share with each other things you wouldn't dream of sharing with anyone else. Let it all out. Let your spouse in. Knowledge is love. Give each other knowledge. Give each other love. Give each other the opportunity to give. The main purpose of asking for what you want is not so you get what you want. It's so your spouse can give you what you want. Giving creates love. That's what's important. Getting is just a bonus. When you interview your spouse, don't worry about not being able to meet some or even many of your spouse's desires. The purpose of the interview is not that your spouse gets what your spouse wants. It's that you have as many opportunities as possible to give what your spouse wants. The fact that your spouse will get some of their needs met will not affect your marriage much. You giving your spouse what your spouse wants, on the other hand, will transform it. If you earn a schoolteacher's salary and your spouse is asking for a big diamond ring, don't worry about it. It's not a problem that your spouse will not get a big diamond ring. The problem is that you can't give it. But that only means that you need to look for other opportunities to give. The idea of the intimacy interview is to get to know your spouse so well that you have an endless list of opportunities to give. Use the following categories to help you during your interviews. Probe each other about each category. Vacation and travel. Conversation. Children and parenting. Family time. Holidays and special occasions. Entertainment. Clothes and jewelry. Food and cooking. Dining out. Exercise. Personal growth. Education. Food shopping. House repairs and maintenance. House organization. Money and investing. Sex. Religion and spirituality. House furniture. House temperature. Extended family. Books. Music. Sports. Physical signs of affection. Household chores. Timeliness. Personal hygiene. Car temperature. Business. Profession. Within each of those categories, use these subcategories to probe even deeper. Frequency. destination, style, class, length, types, topics. When you're finished interviewing your spouse, summarize your notes and review them carefully. Mark your spouse's desires that you can accommodate immediately. Don't worry about what you can't give. Focus on what you can give. Next, make a special note next to the desires that offer you a daily opportunity to give. For example, if your spouse wants you to make coffee in the morning, make that a priority to accommodate. If you're not used to being attentive to your spouse's needs, giving regularly may be a big lifestyle change. Feel free to implement changes slowly. As you begin to give more, you will experience the impact that giving has on your marriage, and you'll be motivated to find more ways to give. Therefore, I suggest you review your notes from the interview each week for at least 2 months. Continue to look for new ways to give to your spouse. You and your spouse will want to make sure your lists remain private. Needless to say, any breach of confidentiality or carelessness with the list could destroy the very bond the lists are intended to help you create. Conduct an intimacy interview once each year. Depending on how much you and your spouse's needs change in the years following your first interview, subsequent interviews could be brief reviews or another lengthy process. In either case, the most important things to probe and listen for after the initial interview are new needs and needs that your spouse shared in previous years that you weren't able to fulfill. New needs are a great opportunity to give in a fresh way. All giving cultivates a core connection. However, there's something special about giving in new ways. Give. Exercise 2.2. Program. Minimum 3 per day per spouse. After you have an inventory of giving opportunities, start exercising gives. Just as you need to eat regularly to give your body nourishment, you need to give to your spouse regularly to give your marriage its fuel. You should give to your spouse at least 3 times per day. Spread your giving throughout the day so that your core connection is constantly being renewed. Try to give at least once in the morning before you part for the day. By the way, the combination of a give, a talk charge, and a touch charge is an amazing way to start every day. Beginnings are important. A good start sets the tone for your entire day together. Try to vary the way you give. The benefit of giving in the same way each day is that once you get into the habit of making the coffee, for example, there will be an automatic daily charge to your core connection. However, the problem is that giving in the same way every day can lose its freshness. It's too easy to begin to make the coffee not as an act of giving, but simply out of habit. Inconsistency in your intention is definitely not a reason to stop giving. However, it is a reason to give in more unusual ways that will be new and exciting for you and your spouse. Review your list regularly in search of new ways to give to your spouse. For example, maybe your spouse asks to be read a love poem occasionally. This is probably not something you'll do every day, but it would add a special spark to any day. Be careful to give only what your spouse wants. Giving your spouse something you want them to have doesn't count unless it's also on their list. Giving your spouse a membership to Weight Watchers if they don't want a diet will not be helpful. Give presents, marriage assessment 2. Rate your giving to your spouse in each of the following categories on a scale from 1 to 10. Calculate your score and compare it with the assessment scale given afterwards. Special occasion gifts. Do you buy your spouse a gift for their birthday, your anniversary, and other special holidays and occasions? How thoughtful is the gift? Did you just buy anything, or could your spouse feel your presence in it? Surprise gifts. Do you give your spouse surprise gifts? Will you sometimes go out of your way for no logical reason to bring your spouse a gift? Chores. Do you give your spouse a break by sometimes doing their chores? How often? Do you have to be asked, or do you sometimes surprise your spouse? Do you expect the same in return, or do you unselfishly give? Are you tuned into when your spouse really needs a break? Do you know when your spouse needs your help? What about all the chores that are not clearly your responsibility or your spouse's? Do you just do them when it needs to be done so your spouse doesn't have to? Do you change the diaper or the light bulb without being asked? Free time. Do you give your spouse free time for themselves by relieving them of obligations or chores? Do you ever take the kids for an afternoon so your spouse can do their shopping, catch up on their work, or just relax? Are you tuned into when your spouse needs some free time to themselves? Your time. Do you give your time to your spouse? Do you listen when your spouse tells you something? Do you ask questions and take the time to take interest? Sex. Are you a giver? Are you concerned about meeting your spouse's needs? Do you ask how they can be met? Do you ask if you have met your spouse's needs? Does satisfying sex to you mean pleasing your partner too? Or do you measure it according to your pleasure? Your presence. How much of your heart and soul is in your giving? Can your partner feel your presence in your presence? Calculate your score. 0 to 25. Out of shape. Try to internalize the discussion in this chapter. Do the intimacy interview and start giving. I bet this assessment touched on some sore spots in your marriage. Make note of them and try to address them. 26 to 55. Average. You understand that giving is important, but something is holding you back from complete, unconditional giving. What is it? Do you need more knowledge of your spouse? Are there particular areas where you're not giving? Can you change that? 56 to 70. Marriage Fitness Champion. Good work. You must know your spouse well and give often. Did you rate yourself accurately? Ask your spouse if they would agree with your ratings. How can you give even more? The most important thing to give. You could conduct your intimacy interviews and give to each other 3 times each day and still not maximize the value of this exercise. You could give everything to your spouse and still not give the most important thing. In order to make music, you need to play the right notes. But to make beautiful music, you need rhythm too. To connect with your spouse, you need to give. But to deeply connect, you need something else too. What's the rhythm of giving? When you give, what's the most important thing to give? It's you. Let me explain. Imagine you get a gift wrap package in the mail. What's the first thing you do? Do you immediately rip it open to see what's inside? No. The first thing you do is look for a return address, right? If there was no return address, you would look for a gift card. You'd probably be thinking, who sent this to me? Why does it matter who sent you the gift? What if I promised you that whoever sent you this gift would receive your appreciation? Would you be willing to forget about who sent you the gift and just enjoy it? You wouldn't. Why not? Because a gift's meaning comes from its giver. What really makes a gift special is not what it is, but who gave it to you. Imagine that Glenn and Patty have been dating for a while. Glenn feels strongly about Patty, but Patty continues to go out with Glenn, not because of her feelings for him, but because she enjoys the expensive restaurants he's able to afford. One night, while they're sitting in the corner of a dimly lit 5-star restaurant with candles burning on the table, Glenn reaches into his coat pocket and places before Patty a small, black felt jewelry box. Patty gets very nervous and sits back on her chair. Glenn opens the box and reveals the sparkle of a spectacular sapphire ring. The ring is beautiful, but Patty can't accept it. She's not interested in the ring because she's not interested in Glenn. Can you imagine wearing an expensive piece of jewelry given to you by someone you don't love? You probably wouldn't do it. Why not? A beautiful ring looks beautiful regardless of who gave it to you. What if someone you loved gave you the same ring? Now you would wear it with joy, right? Why? What's the difference? Imagine a couple of months later, Patty is on a blind date with Brian. Brian is a school teacher, and their dates consist of fast food and long walks on the boardwalk. Patty has deeply connected with Brian and fallen in love. One night, Brian invites Patty out to a diner. In the midst of a crowded, noisy diner, while sitting in a fully lit hardwood booth, Brian takes from his pocket a cheap jewelry box and places it in front of Patty. Patty's face lights up. She begins to shake and sweat. She nervously smiles from ear to ear. Patty is immersed in the moment and oblivious to the customers in the booths around them who are watching. Patty is deeply touched even before she opens the jewelry box. Although the ring itself doesn't compare to the sapphire that Glenn tried to give her, to Patty, it's the most beautiful ring she ever received. The most important thing about a present is that it embodies the presence of the one who gave it to you. When you get a gift from someone you love it, not because of what it is, but because of who gave it to you. One night I made a model of an ancient scroll with my son. We glued the ends of 20 pieces of paper together, colored the long sheet with pictures and letters, rolled it up, wrapped it with a ribbon, and cut a hole in a fancy bag and used it as a protective cover. The whole process took about 45 minutes. The scroll looked handmade, but it lasted a lot longer than most of his store-bought toys. I had no other reason to make that scroll other than to be with my son, and he knew it. He felt my undivided presence. Any toy gift would have lasted a couple of days, but something we made together could have meaning forever. What our children need most are not our presents, it's our presence. They don't need toys, they need us. And toys are not us. We are the gift. The intimacy interview will reveal hundreds of opportunities for you to give to your spouse. In every case, the most important thing to give is you. You have to be within your giving. Your spouse needs to be able to feel your presence in your presence. I can't offer you a formula to succeed with this matter. It's a function of intention. If it comes from your heart, it will go into your spouse's heart. I once heard a story about a man and a woman on a blind date. From the moment they met, the man was talking about himself. He talked about his friends, his work, his travels, and his gym. He went on for hours until finally he said, "That's enough about me. Let's talk about you. What do you think about me?" Love can't be selfish. It can't be all about you. Giving to your spouse can't be about getting love for yourself. Love is the byproduct, but your giving has to be unconditional. And the purest thing you can give is you. It's easy to buy a gift, but the right gift, given at the right time and in the right way, that takes time and energy. That's an art. It's not about money. The size of the gift makes no difference. It's the giving itself that makes the difference. There are two sayings that couldn't be truer. One is, money can't buy you love. And the other is, it's the thought that counts. These sayings share a common message. The most important thing to give is your presence. No matter what you give, make sure you are in it. In the words of Ralph Waldo Emerson, the only gift is a portion of thyself. Love conquers all. My wife and I have four children, all of whom were born prematurely. As is often the case with preemies, our babies had to spend a few weeks in the neonatal intensive care unit, otherwise known as the NICU, at the hospital before we could bring them home. During the time when our babies were in NICU, my wife and I visited the hospital every day to help the nurses care for the babies. We fed them, changed their diapers, burped them, wrapped them tightly in blankets, assisted in the changing of their IVs, and did whatever the nurses would permit us to do. A hospital is not a nice place to spend every day for weeks, but we were committed to being with our babies because we yearned to bond with them, and we knew that that bond wouldn't simply be waiting for us when the babies came home. We knew that if we wanted to connect with our babies, we would have to begin caring for them and giving to them immediately. The care we provided for our babies while they were in NICU helped us connect with them. It changed our experience of their time in the hospital. But what was particularly fascinating to us, which highlights the central theme of marriage fitness, is that giving to our babies changed their experience in the hospital too. The nurses explained, citing medical research, that the more parents of preemies care for their baby, the better it is for the baby's health. How could that be? What does it matter who feeds the baby as long as the baby gets the nutrition it needs? Is the baby even aware of who changes its diaper? In the medical community, the research is indisputable, but the reason is a mystery. I'm not a doctor or a medical researcher, but I believe I can explain. It's simple. Nurses provide medical care. Parents give presents. Giving presents creates love. Love changes everything. Love conquers all. Summary. Giving is usually something we do when we feel love. But the relationship between giving and love works the other way too. You will feel love for those to whom you give. So interview your spouse. Collect an inventory of giving opportunities and give to your spouse at least 3 times each day. And don't forget to give the most important thing, your presence. Chapter 6. Move from me to we. Step 3 of the Marriage Max 4-step plan. There was one part of our wedding that was extraordinary. It's called the Bedeckin. The Bedeckin is an ancient ceremony performed at some Jewish weddings moments before the marriage ceremony. The Bedeckin symbolizes one of the keys to creating a lasting core connection and deep love. Allow me to explain. When it was time for our Bedeckin, I was escorted by the rabbi and some of my friends to a room where most of the guests waited huddled around my wife. When we entered the room, everyone turned toward us. As I was escorted toward my wife, the guests parted one by one just before we converged. I couldn't see my wife, but as the people stepped aside, I knew I was getting closer and being escorted to where she was seated. Eventually, the last row of people surrounding my wife moved aside, and I saw her sitting in an ornate high-backed white chair fit for a queen, holding hands with my mother and my mother-in-law, who sat on either side of her. I approached my wife and performed the ceremonial part of the Bedeckin. I took the veil that was over her head, and I lowered it so that it covered her face. I left the room and waited for my wife to join me under the marriage canopy. The traditional explanation for the Bedeckin is that the groom is checking to make sure he's marrying the right woman, and that he doesn't fall victim to a last-minute switch, as Jacob did in biblical times when he was tricked into marrying Leah instead of Rachel. In the Bible, Jacob waited 7 years to marry Rachel, whom he loved, but on his wedding night, he was duped into marrying Rachel's older sister, Leah. It wasn't until after his marriage to Leah that he married his true love, Rachel. In biblical times, polygamy was acceptable and quite common. The problem with the traditional explanation of the Bedeckin is that it doesn't make sense or hold up to scrutiny. If the Bedeckin was my opportunity to ensure I was marrying the right woman, I wouldn't cover my bride's face. I would uncover it. Symbolically and practically, it makes more sense to lift the veil and reveal her identity than it does to cover her face and conceal it. But in fact, tradition says to lower the veil and conceal her identity. Furthermore, if the bedeckan was my opportunity to confirm I was marrying the right woman and protect myself against being tricked, then after I lifted the veil and revealed her identity, I should immediately escort her to the marriage canopy, never letting her out of my sight. But that's not the tradition of the bedeckan. I didn't escort her to the marriage canopy. I met her there. I separated from my bride for a few minutes after the bedeckan, leaving myself completely vulnerable to the very fate that I am supposedly protecting myself against. In the time that it took my bride to join me under the marriage canopy, another woman could have taken her place, and her identity would have been concealed by the veil. In spite of the traditional explanation, the bedeckan does not protect a man from marrying the wrong woman, nor does it symbolically represent that message. The traditional explanation seems implausible for another reason, too. Is it possible that Jacob could be tricked into marrying the wrong woman? It's not as if Rachel and Leah were identical twins. Rachel was known to be shapely and beautiful. Leah is described as having weak eyes. Did Jacob really not know who he was marrying? Is it possible that he couldn't tell the difference until the next morning, as the verses indicate? A careful reading of the story reveals a more reasonable and insightful understanding of Jacob and the true meaning of the bedeckan. On the day after his wedding, Jacob asked why he was not given Rachel to marry. He does not ask why he was given Leah. In other words, Jacob didn't complain that he married Leah. He complained that he did not marry Rachel. Why didn't he complain about marrying Leah? Would you accept a marriage to someone you had no intention of marrying without putting up a fuss? Jacob was told two things when he asked why he was not given Rachel to marry. He was told that the custom in his community is for the older sister to marry first, and Leah was the older sister. And he was told that he would marry Rachel too. Jacob accepted this response without argument, and in fact, he married Rachel too. But why did this response satisfy Jacob? If you discovered that you married the wrong woman, would you accept your fate because of a local custom? The response satisfied Jacob, but not because he learned that the local custom mandated he marry Leah. The response satisfied Jacob because he learned that he was going to marry Rachel. Let me explain. Jacob lived in the community as a single man for 7 years. He knew the custom was that the older sister marries first. That's why he didn't complain about marrying Leah. Can you imagine being a single man living in a community with such a custom and not knowing it? Jacob knew he had to marry Leah. That wasn't a problem for him. He wanted to marry Rachel. And the fact that he did not, that was a problem for him. So when he was told that he would marry Rachel, he was satisfied. That's all he wanted. He didn't need an explanation for why he married Leah. He knew he had to marry Leah in order to marry Rachel. He knew that to marry the woman of his choice, he had to marry the woman of his fate, too. And that is why the story of Jacob serves as a paragon for a successful marriage. Because the truth is, when you marry Rachel and Leah. You choose your spouse, but that choice includes the future of your spouse, who you don't yet know, your fate. And to succeed in love, you have to commit to both, Rachel and Leah. Your choice and your fate, the revealed and the unrevealed. So what's the meaning of the bedeckan? The bedeckan is a vow of unconditional love. I lowered the veil to hide my wife's face, signifying our unqualified commitment to each other, a commitment that included everything we knew and chose about each other, and everything hidden from each other that we would only discover in the future. Most people don't enter marriage with this attitude. Most people, when they wake up to find Leah lying next to them, complain that Leah was not their choice. Most people become frustrated with their spouse and their marriage when they discover character flaws, problems, and differences. Most people feel so duped into marrying Leah that they divorce Rachel. But it's not possible to marry one without the other. Leah always appears. The key to succeed in love and marriage is to know what to do when she does. Soulmates are not perfect for each other. Soulmates love each other with all of their imperfections. Soulmates love each other no matter what. Step 3 of the Marriage Max 4-step plan for connecting your cores and building love is to embrace your spouse's shortcomings, uniqueness, and challenges. Step 3 is to move from me to we. Take interest in your spouse's interests. Your fate includes your spouse's ever-changing interests. When you met, you shared some of your spouse's interests. And the interests you didn't share, at least you knew what they were. But people's interests change over time. Change, however, in and of itself, is not a threat to your marriage. It's how you react to your spouse's changing interests that determine whether you grow apart or stay connected. Sometimes I hear about marriages between celebrities. One spouse is filming for 6 months in Europe while the other is touring the United States. They talk to each other through the tabloids and plan to spend the holidays together at the end of the year. A Hollywood love affair seems exciting, but like two stars in the sky, there's too much distance between them. They aren't connected. A Hollywood marriage is an extreme example, but some couples live separate lives even when they sleep under one roof. Some couples have separate hobbies, friends, careers, exercise routines, and chores. Their lives parallel each other. They may even be well coordinated, but they do not intersect. And if your lives don't intersect, you will not connect. This is why we're amazed to learn about some couples who split up. Everything seemed fine in their life. In fact, they functioned at a high level. Everything was in order. They succeeded in their job and got along with their family and friends, but they had no connection between them. They had an interesting and active life, but they didn't share it. I knew a man who changed careers to pursue his dream. His work wasn't only how he earned a living, it became his mission in life. But his wife didn't care about his mission. All she cared about were the practical ramifications of his job, like his work schedule, his travel schedule, and his income. His passion for his mission and his wife's lack of involvement in it made it difficult for them to connect. That same man's wife became passionate about gardening. She spent a lot of time in her garden, planting, pruning, and weeding. She also read gardening magazines and talked in internet chat rooms with other gardeners. Unfortunately, her husband wanted nothing to do with her garden. So once again, they grew apart. There are so many ways you can grow apart emotionally from your spouse. Sometimes it's not one area, but an overall lack of interest and involvement in each other's mundane lives that creates the split. In either case, lack of involvement is tantamount to a lack of connection. Falling in love is the opposite experience. In the beginning of a relationship, it's natural to be interested in each other. Couples talk for hours about each other's hobbies. They watch each other play sports. They exercise together. They visit each other at work. They meet each other's friends and family. They go to each other's favorite restaurant. They watch each other's favorite movie. They help each other with projects. They look through each other's photo albums and ask about each other's collectibles. When a couple falls in love, their lives intertwine. Soulmates get involved with each other. They talk about almost everything. They do lots of things together, and everything is fun. This doesn't mean soulmates necessarily share the same interests. My wife had no interest in basketball, but she still came to watch me play. Soulmates get involved with each other, not because they're compatible, but because they want to be soulmates. Involvement with your spouse creates a connection between you and your spouse. Consider how you took an interest in your spouse's life in the beginning of your relationship. Do you remember getting involved with and learning about your spouse's friends, family, profession, interests, and hobbies? Do you see how moving from me to we helped to create love between you? Do you see how taking an interest in your spouse created a connection between you? Are you still active in your spouse's life? Did Lay appear with any new interests? If so, how did you react? Does your spouse have a new job, passion, hobby, or group of friends? Did you get involved with the new aspects of your spouse's life? Did you embrace your fate or reject it? One way to move from me to we is to get involved in as many aspects of your spouse's life as possible. Don't let Leia be a stranger. You and your spouse don't have to be interested in the same things to be soulmates. You only have to be interested in each other. Every new aspect of your lives, every friend, every interest, every hobby, every meeting, every diet, every fitness program, every project, every trip, every phone call, is all an opportunity to move from me to we. Are you living separate lives or building love together? Have you embraced your fate or is Leia estranged? Did you ask about your spouse's sales meeting? Did you go together to pick out the new outfit? Do you jog together or work out separately? Did you shop for the new couch together? You and your spouse have a fixed amount of hours, people, meetings, activities, and meals in your life. How much of it you share and how you share it determines the depth of your connection. Everything is an opportunity to connect with your spouse. As easily as gardening can divide a couple, it can unite a couple. There is nothing inherently divisive about any hobby or interest. Your marriage is impacted not by the hobbies you choose, but by whether or not you take an interest in each other's selections. When you were single and you planned a vacation, the only thing that mattered were the plans you made, and you made them. But in your marriage, your plans are secondary to the planning. It's your involvement with each other that matters most. If you plan the vacation together, if it's a we experience, you'll have a great time and be in the right place. If you make the plans alone, the pictures may not tell the whole story. Imagine you and your spouse's life as two circles. The degree to which you overlap your circles determines the depth of your connection. Soulmates overlap a lot. Soulmates are constantly involved in some way in almost every aspect of each other's life. That doesn't mean soulmates do everything together. That's impossible. And it doesn't mean that their involvement is extensive in all cases. That's impossible too. However, soulmates are part of many aspects of each other's lives in some way. They ask about each other's lives, talk about each other's lives, review each other's drafts, buy things together, shop for things together, research things together, exercise together, read some of the same magazines and books, work on projects together, and play together. Their involvement facilitates their connection to each other. I'm credited as the author of this book, but the truth is, I have a co-author, my wife. My wife wasn't interested in writing a book on marriage success and revealing how we transformed our marriage, but she took an interest because it was my passion. We discussed every part of the book. She read every draft. We spent hours brainstorming about the title and the subtitle. We spent an evening in a bookstore looking at book covers and discussing cover design. But the most important thing about her involvement was not that it made the book better, although it certainly did, but that it made us better. We created the book, but creating it helped to create our love. To move from me to we is not only about getting involved with each other, it's about being intimate. It's possible to be involved with your spouse, but not be connected. The goal is to connect. The most important part of the move from me to we is not the change in your schedule and interests, it's the change in you. When you become we, then you've made the move. Getting involved with your spouse is how you get to know your spouse's thoughts, feelings, dreams, fears, and opinions. Try to appreciate your spouse's interests from their perspective. What need does it satisfy for your spouse? What dream does it fulfill? Try to learn as much as you can about your spouse's inner life, as well as the world of their hobbies and interests. Move your circle of life. Exercise 3.1. To move from me to we requires a consistent consciousness. It's a lifestyle. There's no specific discipline that guarantees success. However, the correct consciousness without a discipline is also likely to fail. Therefore, I want to offer exercises to help you move from me to we. Move Your Circle of Life is designed to transform one of your spouse's interests that cause you to grow apart into one that brings you together. If a man was attracted to his wife partly because she wanted to be a homemaker, their marriage will be challenged when she decides to open an art gallery and work full-time, even though they have four children. Unwelcome interests are objectively neutral, but can be a problem from one spouse's perspective. They can easily cause a couple to grow apart. Think of a few interests or activities that have become a significant part of your spouse's life since you fell in love. Consider the ones with which you're least involved and the ones that most interfere with your marriage. Choose one that offers the best and most realistic opportunity for you to get involved. Now, getting involved does not necessarily mean that you have to do the activity together. It could mean that you watch the activity, plan for it, pack for it, budget for it, buy supplies for it, or research it in preparation for a discussion. How you get involved depends on you, your spouse, and the interest. There are endless possibilities. The goal is to move your circle of life so that it overlaps with your spouse's interest. Choose an interest that's important to your spouse. The more important it is to your spouse, the greater the impact your involvement will have on your marriage. If your spouse jogs 1 hour every day, that's a better choice than science fiction if your spouse reads only one science fiction book each year. Move Your Circle of Life is intended to increase we in your marriage. Don't choose an interest that is already part of your we. If you wanted to strengthen a weak muscle, you would add a new exercise to your physical fitness routine. Choose something that is interfering with your marriage. Choose something that will impact your marriage when you get involved. Consider your interest in the topic when you make your selection. Your spouse's passion for the interest is more important, but if you're trying to decide between two interests that are of equal importance to your spouse, choose the one that interests you more. The more interest you have in the topic, the easier it will be for you to get involved. After you choose one of your spouse's interests, be cautious about how you involve yourself. Don't show up unexpectedly at your spouse's weekly card game. Begin by reading about the subject and educating yourself. Then engage your spouse in discussion about the topic. Ask questions. Show your interest. Consider purchasing a thoughtful gift that relates to your spouse's interest. In time, explore with your spouse how you can get more involved. Be assertive, but make sure you involve yourself in ways that are agreeable to your spouse. The chances are good that your spouse's interest doesn't interest you. If it did, you would probably already be involved. Move Your Circle of Life is challenging in that regard. It takes discipline. Move Your Circle of Life is not an exercise in choosing compatibility. It's an exercise in choosing love. Your interest in your spouse's interest is irrelevant. Your interest in love is the key. Consider a father whose son developed a passion for baseball. One summer, he took his son to see every major league team play one game. Their travels took the entire summer and cost a lot of money, but it did wonders for their relationship. Upon their return, the father was asked, "Do you like baseball that much?" "No," he replied, "but I like my son that much." Ironically, however, the more you get involved in your spouse's interest, the more fun it will be. I know it's hard to imagine. I know you have zero interest in bass fishing, but if your interest in love is genuine, anything can be a source of your connection. And once you connect, everything is fun. Love is all that matters. If you can create love, you'll be happy doing anything together. My son became interested in tennis when he was 4 years old. Occasionally, we played together at the public courts. Anyone watching might have felt sorry for me having to chase the ball all over the court and over the fence. But I had a great time. Did I sign up to be the 4-year-old tennis coach? No. But I would play with my son anytime. Tennis, or any activity, can be fun or boring, fulfilling or meaningless. It depends on the depth of your connection with the person with whom you're involved. Move Your Circle of Life is an opportunity for personal growth, too. Think of your spouse's interests as your new hobby, and consider your spouse your in-house tutor. Take advantage of the situation. View it as an opportunity to expand yourself and your knowledge of the world. Solicit your spouse's thoughts, opinions, and advice on the topic. My wife would not have known the first thing about writing and publishing a book if she didn't take an interest in my passion. Now, she could publish one herself. That's one of the benefits of love. You become more than you were alone. More knowledgeable, more interesting, more experienced, more worldly. True love is self-expanding. Pick a hobby, any hobby. Exercise 3.2. Getting involved in new areas of your spouse's life is not easy. You're probably already involved in the areas of your spouse's life that interest you. In the areas that don't interest you, that's probably why you're not involved. I hope that will change when you move your circle of life and utilize the wisdom of this chapter. But if it's involvement with each other that creates love, let me also suggest an easy way. Talk with your spouse about a new hobby that you can do together. Pick a hobby, any hobby. It can be anything you and your spouse wish. Here are a few ideas. Investing, Thai massage, cooking, tennis, square dancing, poetry, dried flowers, body painting, acupuncture, gardening, wine tasting, antiques, Bible study, karaoke, bird watching, fly fishing, baking, rollerblading, bicycling, stamp collecting, and astronomy. Make sure the hobby you select is a shared interest. It should be something fun for both of you. Move your circle of life can be challenging. Pick a hobby, any hobby, should be easy. Once you select your hobby, get into it. Search the internet, send away for information, visit the local library, join an association, sign up for a newsletter, register for a seminar, enroll in a class, visit a bookstore, talk to experts, and do it. There's just one rule. You have to do it together. Your new hobby can be a great topic for your talk charges and super talk charges. It can be a great idea for date night. It can be a theme for a romantic retreat. There are also so many creative ways to give to your spouse when you have a shared interest. Once you pick a hobby, see how well you can incorporate it into the other exercises suggested in Marriage Fitness. My wife and I recently picked reading as our hobby. There was an intriguing self-help book that we both wanted to read, so we decided to read it together. My wife reads aloud, I listen, and we talk about the author's point whenever we feel inspired. Sometimes we read for a few minutes. Sometimes we read for a couple of hours. Sometimes we take the book to Starbucks, and presto, date night. If it's time for a super talk charge, we can always count on reading the book aloud to stimulate an intimate dialogue. For us, reading a self-help book is a great hobby to share because not only do we connect by being together, but also through the richness of our discussions. You might consider reading as your hobby too. Instead of self-help, maybe you want to read love poems, mystery novels, or classic literature. How about reading Marriage Fitness together? Make room for love. Exercise 3.3. Consider a husband who is obsessed with a computer game. Every night, he comes home from work and invests his final waking hours and emotional energy into beating his top score. Can you imagine how annoyed his wife is losing the battle for his attention night after night to a computer game? To make matters worse, he occasionally demands her attention at midnight when she's exhausted. Sometimes the challenge is not for one spouse to get involved with the other's interest, but for the other spouse to drop the interest for the benefit of the marriage. If you and your spouse implement Move Your Circle of Life and pick a hobby, any hobby, you will share some new interests. But if you're like most couples, you've built an extensive life exclusive of your spouse, there are probably still interests and activities that contribute to your me and detract from your we. What are those interests? To what extent are they outside the context of your marriage? How often and for how long do they separate you from each other? To what extent do they disconnect you emotionally? The last two exercises accomplish the move from me to we by increasing we. Make Room for Love accomplishes it by decreasing me. Think about a few of your interests and hobbies that detract from your marriage. Select one interest or hobby that detracts from your we and try to live without it. Do you have a favorite TV show that doesn't interest your spouse? Don't watch it anymore. Do you go away with a friend for a 3-day golf outing every year? Don't go this year. Do you play in a bowling league every Wednesday night? Plan to spend the time at home instead. Search your life for something that interferes with your marriage and try to live without it. Limit me and make room in your circle of life for more we. Be careful not to pick something that will make you bitter, but also try to pick something that will have a meaningful impact on your marriage. It's hard to trade me for we, but your life ended when your marriage began. Now it's time for we, and for that, you need to make room. Some couples don't connect because their lives outside the context of their marriage are too big. There's simply no time and energy for another person. Cut something out. Make space for your spouse. In the end, you'll lose a hobby, but you'll gain love. It's one of the best trades you'll ever make. Consider your selection carefully. If poker is your passion, it might be better for your spouse to try to get involved with your poker game rather than you eliminating it from your life. On the other hand, if poker is not important to you and your spouse is not involved in it, then maybe it is a good choice. I'm not suggesting that you and your spouse should never spend time away from each other. Everyone needs private time, and it's also reasonable to have interests that don't involve your spouse. The goal here is to remove one interest that interferes with your marriage. It's a judgment call, one you might consider making together. I appreciated my wife's interest in my basketball game, but I don't play anymore. It took too much time, and except for watching an occasional game, it was too difficult for my wife to be involved. It's still important for me to be physically fit, so I speed walk on the treadmill at home. It takes less time, and we can talk while I'm exercising, or I do it early in the morning before everyone in the house wakes up. I miss playing basketball, but it was not worth the time and energy it took from my marriage. My wife's leg hurts us. Your spouse's character flaws, problems, and misfortunes are part of your fate too. When your spouse's neatness turns out to be a compulsive neurotic disorder, your marriage has a problem. When your spouse is diagnosed with a life-threatening illness, your love will be tested. The secret to handling these types of discoveries successfully is to move from me to we. As a child and teenager, your primary concern was yourself. You probably got at least 20 years practice being selfish. When you were a baby, you cried until you were fed. You didn't care if it was 3 o'clock in the morning and your mom was asleep, or 2 o'clock in the afternoon and she was on an important phone call. All you cared about was satisfying your hunger. You know, when mothers nurse, it's important they get enough calcium in their diet. It's not important for the baby. It's important for them. Their baby will get enough calcium regardless. The question is whether it will come from the mother's diet or from her teeth. Either way, the baby will take it. Babies only know me. Most of us become big babies. Some people are so selfish, they only love their dogs because they can train them to obey their command. But selfish people are always disappointed in marriages because people can't be trained. They're unpredictable. Dormant problems get revealed and misfortune strikes. Leia always appears. Selfishness can get you most of what you want, except what you need most. Love. Love requires a new state of mind. Love requires a move from me to we. To change the word me to we, you flip the M. Turn it upside down. True love requires you to change your perspective 180 degrees. Not only are your problems your problem, but your spouse's problems become your problem too. Sometimes that means your life gets turned upside down. True love is unconditional. When you and your spouse discover your differences, flaws, and problems, that's not when your marriage ends. It's when you move from me to we and build lasting love. Of course you didn't expect him to have a fierce temper. I know you didn't know she was sexually abused by her stepdad. No one wanted him to have a stroke. But for a marriage to succeed, you have to commit to Rachel and Leia. You have to accept your choice and your fate. This is the art of loving, making a space in your life for the entirety of another person. It's easy to embrace your spouse's good attributes and joy in life. That's not love. That's compatibility. You can't love some of your spouse. True love is inclusive of flaws, differences, and tragedy. True love includes your fate as well as your choice. I know a man who discovered after 10 years of marriage that his wife was an alcoholic. At first, he was angry, but later he shared with me that it was the turning point in their marriage. After he got over the initial shock and disappointment, he supported his wife in her battle. The more he showed his support, the more she revealed about her inner struggle, and the more intimate they became. It was an extremely challenging ordeal, but one that deeply connected them. Love is like a hug. You can't hug a piece of your spouse. You have to open your arms and let in the whole person. When you hug, there's no space between you. You're completely connected. If you want to sculpt two people hugging, you begin with one block of clay, not two. Love is a process of two people becoming one. A husband takes his wife to the doctor to have her leg examined. When it was her turn to see the doctor, they went in together. The doctor asked what was wrong. The husband responds, "My wife's leg hurts us." To succeed in marriage, you have to live with your spouse's flaws just as you live with your own. In love, in we, your spouse's flaws are your own. People say love is blind. True love is not blind. True love is seeing and still loving. You don't have to like your spouse's flaws. I'm sure you don't like your own. As discussed in Chapter 2, you can work together to change them. But the key to creating love is not changing them. It's embracing them. Changing them is the ability to build a thing. Embracing them will create love. That's the most important thing. I used to feel that my wife's flaws were compromising the quality of my life. Certain things were a disappointment to me. But then I realized that my life was being compromised not by her flaws, but by my attitude. To move from me to we and embrace the frailties of my wife was not self-limiting, it was self-expanding. The more problems I embraced, the more we connected. Ironically, problems that seem to inhibit love can create a connection that produces love. What a wonderful way to think of your spouse's problems as an opportunity to connect and create love. A good marriage is a team. The issue is not who's at fault. The issue is how we can solve the problem. Consider you and your spouse a team, and your problems your opponent. Look for solutions, not blame. Use your problems to unite you, not divide you. What flaws and problems have been revealed by your spouse? How did you react to discovering them? Are you on the same team trying to resolve them? Or do you blame your spouse for them? Do you think you have embraced your fate? Or are you fighting to reject it? The following insight may help you embrace your spouse's flaws. Everyone has their blessings and curses. In most cases, both stem from the same personality trait. For example, my wife appreciates my emotional strength and clarity of thought. She's challenged by my stubbornness. Both the blessing and the curse, however, originate from the same attribute. Think about this in the context of your marriage. What do you love most about your spouse? What do you dislike most about your spouse? Does your like and dislike originate from the same quality? Do you see how your spouse is a package deal? You can't change what you don't like without changing what you do like. Rachel and Leah are the same person. You can't marry one without marrying the other. Imagine you and your spouse are two different color translucent strips. If you put your strips on top of one another, you get a third color. That's what it means to move from me to we. It's a big change, but it's not a compromise or sacrifice. The new color still includes 100% of your original color, and much more. You've expanded. You have new interests, problems, insights, hobbies, attributes, and most importantly, you have love. Be a team. Exercise 3.4. Think of a few of your problems and flaws. Consider the one your spouse accepts the least. Consider also the one your spouse criticizes or attacks you for the most. Maybe they're the same one. Choose one of them and invite your spouse to help you solve that problem. Use a date night, a romantic retreat, or a super talk charge to share with your spouse the details of your problem. Try to describe the root of your struggle. Talk about your childhood, a life-changing incident, an accident, a tragedy, or medical details if they're relevant. Share your thoughts, feelings, fears, and insights regarding your struggle. Allow yourself to be vulnerable. Reveal your inner life. And finally, invite your spouse to battle your problem with you. Tell your spouse how they can help. Be as specific as possible. The more involved your spouse gets, the more you will connect, and the more love there will be in your life. Invest together in solving the problem. Read about it, research it, talk to experts, consult with therapists or medical doctors, talk with others who have the same struggle, and surf the internet for information. The goal of Be a Team is not to solve the problem, although I hope you do. The goal is to transform the problem from one that divides you into one that unites you. In a marriage, problems are not a problem. They're neutral. They can either destroy love or create love. It depends on how you and your spouse handle them. If you're on the same team, you can live with anything. If you're not, the slightest problem will drive you nuts. I'm purposely not discussing how you and your spouse should solve your problem. That's an important discussion, but it doesn't belong in this book. This book is about how to create love. I'm sure there are other books about how to solve your problem, and you should read them together. But to create love, you don't have to solve your problem. You only have to attack it together. Teamwork creates love.
You have reached the end of Disc 4. Please insert Disc 5.